It is 23A2 in the English. 23A2 in the English. We are on the left side of the English page. Last paragraph on the left side. Okay, this is a somewhat new subject. Tanu Rabbanan. Tanu Rabbanan is the introduction, you remember, to a Baraita. This is a Baraita. Kol Shloshim Yom Legihut. Echad Kelim Chadashim, Echad Kelim Ishanim, Yotzim Mitoch Amachpesh. All the 30 days, so we're talking about Shloshim, including, of course, Shiva. So including beginning with Shiva and going right to the end of the 30-day period of mourning, L'gihutz, that is to say, it applies for Gihutz. Now Gihutz, we have a translation of Gihutz in modern Hebrew, and it probably means the same thing, but we can't really be sure. Gihutz, we translate it to irony. So in other words, is not allowed to wear ironed clothes for 30 days. Okay? One cannot wear, as it says here, freshly pressed clothing for 30 days. Now, as I said, it's not exactly clear what Gihutz means, but keep in mind that we already briefly discussed the fact that Tichboset, which was translated as washing of clothes, is prohibited during Shiva. So you're not allowed to wash clothes during Shiva. Here we have something that is, first of all, longer than Shiva, and secondly, it extends beyond washing, and it's Gihutz, or it appears to extend beyond washing. If you look at the English comment down at the bottom on comment number 21, it makes reference to the fact that before we had learned about Tichboset, that's on 15A4, our definition of Gihutz as pressing follows Rashi in the manuscript Rashi. And Rashi took it to Vot 10b. The laundered clothing were placed on a perfectly smooth table and then rubbed with a glass stone until they developed a sheen. Now, it's interesting to think about the technology of ironing, because it's a very old technology, ironing. You can see, I remember when I was a kid, we went to Cooperstown, and then you go to Williamsburg, to see colonial technology, and surely you always see an iron. And of course, an iron is made up of, you either put coals in it, or you take it and you just put the iron in the fireplace, remove the iron, and even the English word that we have, ironic, is an indication of the fact that you used a heavy piece of iron, which got extremely hot, and it kept its heat for enough time to be able to effectively press the clothes.
Steindl shows an image of a clothes press, a rather elaborate thing from the time of the Mishnah, but he too says it's uncertain as to the exact meaning.
Because the commentators will, some of them call it the clothes press, and let's see whether he has here, well, later on, when it mentions the machpesh, is that a word used in modern Hebrew? Machpesh?
No, but they used to have an old machine that you used to put the dinim.
Okay.
That was the machpesh.
That's what I understand as a machpesh, correct. I don't remember how you say it in English.
It's a roller.
So when I was a kid, and even to the time that I was a teenager, we used to have these pressing things. First of all, there was one that had rollers on it. A mangnol, that's what it was called. Hey, yeshakach. I forgot that word. That's right, it was called a mangnol. That's what it was called in English, right? It's called a mangle. You remember what a mangle is, right? So a mangle.
A mangle is generally when they. It's not just. It's pressing, it's for washing.
Well, washing and pressing. There was a washing, there was a roller. When I was a little kid, we had a roller, and my mother would put things in the wash tub, and it would go like that a bunch of times. Then you take it out of there, and we used to feed it through the roller. And there was a time it was a hand roller, and it would go through the roller. Then it was mechanized. I remember the rollers got to be mechanized. That was one thing. And then there was what we called the mangle, which I don't know whether it was technically correct, but it was called the mangle. And that was sort of like almost, it was a pressing machine that had a hot piece of metal, if I remember correctly, or there were different ways you could use it. One had a piece of metal on it, and then it was just these two things that would press together like that, and you'd open it. It was something that you had at home. It wasn't something that you would have to go to the dry cleaner for, where you see a presses. So that kind of technology, it's just interesting that the technology of taking clothes that have been washed and of making them smooth is probably as old as clothes are. That the desire to have nice looking clothes and that to be connected with the smoothness of the clothes goes way, way, way back in civilization. So here you see the Gemara is obviously referring to some sort of technology which achieves that result. Okay? So it goes on and says, Echad kelim chadashim. So when it says, and this is very hard to understand what it's really getting at, because it says, for 30 days, the laws of Gihut apply, in effect. So then it says, Echad, it is true for new garments, kelim chadashim, Echad kelim yishanim yotzim mitoch ha-machtesh. And it is true for old garments that come out of the mangle. Okay? So I don't know what this is saying to that, because I don't know whether this is sort of introducing something new and saying, well, there are two things here. One is new garments, and things that come out of the press are treated as if they are new garments. That is to say, now, since we've mentioned the gihuts, we now say that gihuts, in effect, is like having a new garment as far as the laws of mourning are concerned. And I understand that. Because when you have a nicely ironed garment, it feels good to put it on. It is like a new garment. I remember we had a comic years ago, the early days of Oz Arua. He told me he never sent his suits to the dry cleaner. So I said, well, what did you do after? Well, I got a new suit. So, not everybody could do that, I said to him. I said, but tell me, I have a question. Why don't you send your suits to the dry cleaner? Why don't you send them? So he says, you take a new suit, a new wool suit, beautiful suit, beautiful, you enjoy wearing it. Send to the dry cleaner one time, it's destroyed. Says, because the whole nub of the fabric, the nap of the fabric, the feel of the thing, which feels so good when it's new, once you send it to the chemical dry cleaner, it takes that whole thing out of it. Indeed, it's pressed nicely, it's clean, but it doesn't feel the same. I said, all right, I'm happy to hear why you don't send your clothes to the dry cleaner. some people can live like that. It's very nice. But here again, I think there is a sense of the newness or the cleanness or the pressedness of the garments when they come out of this process. So it could be that what this is saying is that things that have been pressed are, as far as the law of mourning concern, the same as kelim chadashim, as if they're new clothes. Or it could be saying something somewhat different. Look at the note 22 here. After the clothes are pressed, they are folded and clamped in a special press which gives them a particularly nice look. old clothes that undergo gihutz and come out of the press are like new clothes. Some explain that coming out of the press refers specifically to old clothes. Only old clothes require placement in a press after gihutz. After gihutz, so it's two types of things. One is gihutz, that you do on stones maybe, and then something else that's put in a machpesh. But new clothes that have been processed with gihutz, so even new clothes were processed. Now that's entirely possible. Even when you buy a new suit. You buy a new suit, I'm sure it's true for a new dress too. Something's been done to it. A new suit has a crease in it. Even if it's new, something has been done to it. So maybe that's what we're referring to here, that new things have stuff done to it, and older things have stuff done to them as well. And both, as far as the laws of mourning, are considered to be equivalent. Okay, I'll go back to the text. Rebbe Omer, that's Rabbi Judah the Prince. Okay, Rabbi Judah the Prince says, Lo asru ela kelim chadashim bilvat. Very interesting. Rebbe says the only prohibition is on new clothes. So he excludes the whole category of what we just said about kihutz. There was an equivalency here, which the Gemara is very explicit about, the kelim meguatzim are like new. But he says, no, the laws of the 30 days of mourning only apply to gihut, only apply to new clothes. Okay? So he says, lo asu ela kelim chadashim bilvat. Then Rabbi Elazar, but Rabbi Shimon Amer, Rabbi Elazar, the son of Rabbi Shimon, says, Lo asru ela kelim chadashim levanim bilvat. The only clothes that we're forbidden to wear during shloshim, and shloshim means after Shiva now. Okay? The only clothes that are prohibited here are white clothes.
White new clothes.
White new clothes, correct. White new clothes. Everything else is okay. Everything else is okay. Now you can see the example. Abaya nafik the guard of the Sabra. Abaya went out, assumingly now during Shloshim, dressed in a sarbala as a coat. Guard of the Sabra is translated here as a teaseled coat. Now I had to read the note. I never heard those words in English before. Are you familiar with the term teaseled? Read what the note says down here. Okay. The coat, the sarbala, was teaseled, i.e. its nap, hairy surface, was raised through combing, and it was thus restored to look like new. Okay? Tell me what the proper term is. Excuse me? Say it again?
A
boucle. Mazda boucle. I've heard the word, but I don't know what it is.
It's wool,
yeah.
And it has a raised part to it, but not a nap. Uh-huh. It can be for a woman's coat or dress.
I think I know what you mean, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's
right.
It's
a bill. Many years ago, yeah, boucle.
Huh, very nice.
We consider it now an elegant fabric.
Yes, I would imagine. I would imagine it would be elegant. Okay. So here he went out during Shloshim in a coat like this, Karebi. Karebi, according to Rebbe. Because Rebbe said that only new clothes were forbidden. All right, so this is a teaseled coat, must have been a used coat, where you bring the surface up to the nap again, you bring it back to life, so see, it's by definition used. Right? It's a used thing that's just treated properly. Rabbi Nafik v'chimutzta raumita sumata chadati. Rabbi went out again during Shloshim in a chimutzta raumita. Okay, raumita, you know what that is? That's Roman. All right, that's Roman. He went out in a, and here the translation is a cool translation. It's a Roman tunic. Right, he went out in a Roman tunic sumata. In a red Roman tunic. Mm-hmm. Rabbi Elazar ben Rabbi Shimon, according to the opinion of Rabbi Elazar ben Rabbi Shimon. Because Rabbi Elazar ben Rabbi Shimon says that if it's not white, that you can do it even if it's new. Okay? So he wore a red one. He wore a red one and it was okay. Okay?
Question or comment, I don't know. It's interesting that they discuss here men's clothing. What do the women do with their clothes?
Well, it's the same thing. Essentially, the same laws will apply. It's essentially the same thing. Now, I want to read to you, and that's the end of the section here, I want to read to you the comments here of Rabbi Lamb in his discussion about what the law is and what the reasoning is behind these laws. Has a section in the Jewish Way in Death and Mourning.
What page?
Page 130. Laundering and New Garments.
Maurice Lamb.
Maurice Lamb. 130. The principle of avoiding pleasure during mourning also applies to the prohibition of laundering or wearing fleshly laundered clothes during Shiva and Shloshim. The mourner must deny himself certain pleasures while continuing to exercise normal standards of hygienic care and personal dignity. One of the quiet daily delights is the donning of laundered and pressed clothes. It is a feeling of refreshing newness that prepares one for the toil of the day. Being properly and carefully dressed creates a healthy frame of mind. Carlyle, the French essayist, maintained that the first impulse of man from ancient times is, quote, putz, ornamentation or dressing up. Thus, the universal practice of dressing up for the Sabbath. This spirit of newness and the fresh start is contrary to the mental attitude of the mourner. Now goes into mourning. His mind is gripped by the end of days and times gone by. The mourner looks not forward but backward to the past, one portion of which has just been closed shut. It is a past lived with one very close to him, with whom he was emotionally intertwined, who is now deceased. The days of mourning are filled with review, not with plans, with a relationship ended, not a new beginning, an era terminated without any recommencement in sight. In such a mood, the newly pressed shirt is out of place. New clothes are a contradiction of the inner spirit. While washed and tailored clothes for the mourning occasion surely may not be worn, the wearing of clean clothes is mandatory. Now that's a distinction that isn't obvious in what we just read in the Talmud, in which he tries to bring up. If the only clothes available are soiled, they must be washed, and may then be worn. Tradition thus permits the mourner to wear freshly washed garments for cleanliness only, but not for pleasure.
So you can't iron it after you wash it.
You could do whatever you have to do if it's a question of cleanliness. Now, for most people, ironing is not an issue of cleanliness. I can imagine for some people it could be. There are people, I remember one of the nice things of being in a hotel, where, I mean, once in a while I've been in a hotel where I've given myself the greatest of all luxuries. I never give much, because that much luxury I can't even allow. But it's to send some underwear in. And the thrilling thing is that it comes back I don't know about the lives you live, but I don't miss that kind of life.
Well, I
and
have
it's just,
you.
Well, God bless you. It's wonderful. You live the good life, not like us simple people.
More information than I think we would like.
Right.
But the heat also gives bacteria.
Oh, I'm very good. So I'm sure there's a good hygienic reason for it all. But, you know, there are some people also for whom these things are very important. for most of us, I would assume there's a baseline where we can define the difference between what we consider cleanliness or hygienic garments and something which would be a mishigas. But for other people who have that mishigas, they wouldn't see it as a mishigas exactly. But that's how people are. So I can imagine that the lines could be blurred, and then that would be perfectly fine. Because you see, what the distinction here is the distinction of cleanliness or pleasure. For the purpose of cleanliness, you can do things. For pleasure, you can't do things. And there are general standards that usually apply and that usually work. Which is not to say that they'll always apply, they'll always work. Laundering. Two laws are involved in the laundering of clothes during Shiva. One. No, Shiva. We're reading about Shloshim. He's now referring to Shiva. One, the mourner may not wash clothes, even if only to soak them in plain water, or even in preparation for wearing them the week after, as this is considered work and prohibited during the Shiva. So that's actually a different issue. Okay? The only exception is the case of an infant's clothes when no one else is available to do them. So that makes sense. Two, the mourner may not wear freshly laundered clothes that have been washed either by someone else during Shiva or even before the demise. Thus, A, the mourner is not permitted to wear freshly laundered or freshly pressed clothes during the days of Shiva. He should wear clean clothes that were worn to the funeral or at any time previously, but by no means clothes that are soiled. B, if the clothing becomes soiled, he should wash the spot. And if that proves difficult, he should change the garments. Okay? C. Shirts and blouses, trousers, underclothes, socks or stockings, or other garments that touch the body and are liable to absorb sweat and bodily odor may be changed when necessary, even during Shiva. Now, that's an important innovation that he's saying here. He's taking the level of cleanliness and saying that, generally speaking, when clothes touch the body, they absorb body odor and dirt from the body of any kind, and therefore they can, when they get to a certain point that you deem them to be unclean, you can change them. D. Handkerchiefs and bed sheets follow the law of underclothing referred to above. A freshly washed tablecloth may be used for the Sabbath, but not for weekdays. E. In honor of the Sabbath, a freshly washed shirt and simple Sabbath outer garments may be worn. Undergarments, however, should not be changed on the Sabbath unless they are not clean. Publicly, the mourner dresses up for the Sabbath. Inwardly, he remains in mourning even on the Sabbath. So that's an interesting twist, and we'll be reading more about the Shabbat and the extent to which the laws of mourning apply on the Shabbat. The general principle that we'll be dealing with is what he is mentioning here, and that is that publicly there is no mourning on the Sabbath, or more or less there's no mourning on the Sabbath. Privately, there is. So even in the world of garments, there are private garments and there are public garments, so that a distinction is made even on that level. F. New clothes may not be worn during Shiva, even on the Sabbath. G. After Shiva, until Shloshim, the mourner may wash his clothes without detergents and press them. So, again, that is the liberal position that we just read in the Gemara. That's not what we started out with. And remember, the laws of mourning are lakula. They generally take the more lenient position. Where there are two or more positions that are mentioned in the Gemara, in most cases, unless there be some special reason, in most cases, it will be the lenient position that becomes the law. So that, in fact, is what we're reading here. Right? During Shloshim, the mourner may wash his clothes and press them. If a mourner wishes to wear new garments, now this is an interesting custom, which I've never known anyone to do, but it's on the books. He should have someone wear these particular articles of clothing for a short while so that they will no longer be considered new. Yes, I've heard of it too. You hear of it, I've never seen it, but I've heard of it. Underclothes may be worn by the mourner without the above restrictions. Okay?
That follows, you know, that follows logically from what was said before.
Oh, exactly. It basically follows from what was said before, because in fact, what we have learned from the Gemara, if we take the lenient position, is in effect, anything is okay as far as Shloshim goes. But even having said that, it just seems a little bit uncomfortable. So it seems a little bit too lenient. And therefore, what happens over time is you develop customs, and this odd one where somebody else will wear the clothes first before you put them on. Okay? But from the perspective of the strict letter of the law, you see the lenient position is what is in fact the law.
Was that written before the 60s or after?
I'll tell you in a minute. Before people began to be slobs?
Yeah, exactly.
You'll excuse my moment of honesty? 1969, this is coming. Right.
Because in the 60s, of our generation, dressed up and used dirty clothing was pleasurable. To have to wear clean press clothes was uncomfortable.
Right.
Exactly the opposite.
Correct. That never made its way into Jewish law. It's true.
I guess I have a problem with the idea, this concept of making the mourner feel less comfortable than he has to be in the moment when he's so concerned with other things. Why make him more uncomfortable by having to wear unpressed clothes?
One of the themes of mourning which we have seen is in fact the infliction on a person of a certain amount of discomfort.
Why?
Because I would suggest that it is part of the psychology of mourning. That when you lose someone, one of the reactions is a reaction of affliction and self-punishment. And one of the things that any psychiatrist will tell you that, much of what psychiatry deals with is the extent to which people punish themselves for the guilt that they feel. Soloveitchik, last year we studied Rabbi Soloveitchik, says that the principal psychological framework for mourning is one of self-punishment, because one feels that the time you feel guilty for the fact that you haven't been in a relationship what you should have been in that relationship. Okay? And therefore, a normal reaction is punishment. The problem with punishment is that one punishes oneself too much. So what you have is legislated punishment of a mild kind. To say, yes, it's actually healthy to have a little bit of punishment, but not too much. Right? That's the psychology, for what it's worth. I have a teacher, Rabbi Paddock, who's a rabbi now out of Long Island. Rabbi Paddock also used to argue that one, and I think that it's true, that one of the, so you could say, well, no, I don't feel that way. You know, what if you don't feel that way? Rabbi Paddock argued that the laws of mourning, even if you don't feel that way, tries to make you feel that way. Because it's the nature of human feeling that we should, for a short period of time, go through some of these experiences, even if they don't come naturally. They should be legislated. That's the logic.
Another aspect is, though, that you shouldn't lose sight of it, because I think there is a potential of making a party. You know, everyone is coming that people have known. And if there isn't the definite boundary of keeping in mind the purpose of this, there can be a human kind of sliding into socialization that is not appropriate.
Which is what we experience. Mm-hmm. We know the world of the Shiva party, and not of the Shiva mourning. And it's very difficult if you're a sensitive person and you do operate as a socially responsive person to allow yourself, in fact, to have a certain barrier around yourself, to be depressed, to feel bad in the presence of other people. This gives you public sanction for that. The public knows, if the public is familiar with this, that there's nothing wrong with you when you're doing that, that it's okay to do that. So in a way, it creates a permissive state for certain types of behavior, which are not unusual behavior, and which people should be allowed to have in an otherwise social environment. I think that's a good point.
Do all of the things that you just said, okay, relating to the survivor, okay, do any of the rules of mourning, okay, have benefit to the dead? I mean, this whole idea of, do you do this to show respect for a dead person? Does the dead person, are they do that, okay, do they benefit
good question.
From it?
The answer is no.
Oh, the Kaddish, no?
Yes, but none of these things. Kaddish, yes, but none of these customs have anything to do with the dead. They have only to do with the survivors, as far as I can see. They don't have anything to do with the dead. And it's an interesting point, because people will say that. People will say that, you know, they will base their mourning practices on what the deceased wished. In effect, I mean, we can understand that that's something that people say and how they feel, and it's a normal context for responding to a death. But as far as the law goes, it's irrelevant. It's nothing to do with that.
To the comment and the question, I think, as we've seen with a lot of the discussion here, there's a dynamic of going back and forth between the rule to have an effect on the mourner and the rule to deal with the community. In some sense, it's sort of pasnish, you know, to see a mourner walking on the street in new duds and looking great and strutting around. It makes the community feel awkward.
Good point.
And so the rules, I think, are meant to go back and forth.
The law will not work in the 7 days.
Well, but we're talking even 30 days
here.
I mean, there's... I think that's the point as well.
Yeah, my reaction to Rava walking out in a brand new red Roman tunic. What's he, crazy? why was he doing that?
It's embarrassing. I mean, it's puzzling.
Right.
Just like that. So,
but now, why does Rabbi Lamp? This is the most lenient. This is the lenient rule.
I didn't get to the end.
Oh.
Listen, go down a little bit further. Let me just go a little further, because it's relevant to Dan's point here. Time concludes now with a section on new clothes, which is what we were talking about here. One, during Shloshim, one may not wear new clothes even if they are dyed. That's the issue. Thus changing their original color. That goes back, I think, to the Rava story. And the law, in fact, doesn't follow Rava here. It does not follow Rava. Even mourners for relatives other than parents may not wear new clothes until after Shloshim. Exceptions may be made under certain circumstances, which can be evaluated by a rabbi. So you see that what happened to the law was that the law responded to really clamp down on this kind of newness, and I wouldn't be surprised by exactly the reason that you said. Concluding then, technically mourners for parents may don new clothes after Shloshim. However, common Jewish usage has urged them not to buy new clothes during the entire year. Therefore, if the mourner finds it necessary to buy new clothes, or if there has been a demonstration of social reproach, friends urging a change of wardrobe, or your wife, or if a festival is approaching, the mourner may purchase new clothes. In this case, however, as in the case of mourners for relatives other than parents in the midst of Shloshim, one should have a new garment worn for a short while by a friend or a relative. Okay? So you see that, in fact, the law came around to, if not solidly reject that position, to limit it very simply.
I have a question. We are assuming here that the mourner is genuinely sorry for his or her loss, but there are mourners who are delighted with the loss.
That's correct. That's why I said
unhappy marriage who can't get out.
That's why I said to in my response to Mark before, that was Rabbi Plattick's point of view. Rabbi Plattick said that in that case, you should still mourn because you should remember that there's a problem here. You should do it right anyway. And that too teaches a personal lesson. Teaches a personal lesson.
Yeah, we learned that you mourn for a parent even if the for a full year, even if the relationship was strained.
Correct. Yeah. Correct. Marriage is the parent. Now, there are certain circumstances, which of course, there are odd and extreme circumstances that we read about, particularly if you read the newspaper. And it seems like the whole world went to pot and you know, mothers are putting their babies in garbage cans, and so, you know, it's just, this is just the way
that's
life
the latest,
is lived.
That's the latest burial spot. Yeah. You read several women have put them in garbage cans.
I know, this is the new fad.
Yes, it's the new fad.
I mean, but we shouldn't think that real life is really lived on that level. Yeah, there are weird things that go on, but by and large, there's another level of continuum, I think, which, even though there are parameters for it, are not that extreme.
Just since you brought up contemporary scene, at least in American society, we have a new profession. This is called grief counselor. I think in the secular community, they could use a set of well-defined rules, for instance, say etiquette, so that when bad things happen, people aren't total loss.
That's very true. And one of the things that we see, and we see it in the Revenant, is that there is a level of religiosity that, well, I can't say all Jews will reflect this, many do, where their observance of the mourning customs will be much more stringent than their observance of Sabbath or Kashrut or any of the things that God gave to Moses on Mount Sinai don't have even half the power as, at least for some people, the mourning customs will. And it could be for this reason, that there's a good psychological reason for it, that it works, and people want it, they need it, and
so
they have access to it.
In the non-Jews, in the secular community, if people didn't feel when something bad happened, that I feel like I should be doing something. Tell me what I'm supposed to be doing.
Right.
Bad things happen.
Sure.
Okay. Is there any special ruling about the clothing of the deceased?
What happens to those clothes?
There
are customs about such things. Generally, the custom is to give such things away, to give them to charity. In most circumstances, one is counseled to give to charity. But I can understand there would be circumstances where there are exceptions also, where certain pieces of clothing have sentimental value and they want to be kept or used by others. So there isn't any law that you have to give such things away, but it's just what is generally done. Okay.
I have a relative that his wife passed away, and she was very sick. So I was sure that, you know, this was expected for a long, long, long period of time. I asked him, how are you going to see him? He said, I must, because all my people who work with me wants to come.
Mm-hmm.
And he basically said Shiva because he doesn't have other relatives. I'm one here in the States, I didn't know. So his, people who work with him, in where he works, to come and pay respect. And he said it was fine. But
yeah, I will often hear that. Somebody told me just recently that when they were sitting Shiva, some of the most meaningful visits they had were from co-workers, because they didn't expect them to show up. And there are certain people who they had expectations would show up. And then, you know, secretaries, not your secretary, but somebody else's secretary came. The office kind of organized to pay Shiva calls. Gentiles, as Gentiles or Jews, made no difference. And it was very touching to this person who was telling me about it. It really meant a great deal. And there is a sense of emptiness that many mourners feel. And when you feel that compassion and that affection that comes from people who you didn't expect to feel it from, it can go a long way toward just helping you at a time when you need that help. See? Good, let's go on. Okay, now we are, for the first time in a long time, going to go back to a Mishnah. This Mishnah appeared on page Daf Yud Tet Amud Aleph, 19a. Maybe we'll just look at that. 19a2. Which in itself is an interesting point. The fact is that we have so much Gemara for so little Mishnah. That's a literary characteristic which we should just note of this particular Masechet, because these laws are laws of the rabbis. And these are laws that really reflect what was happening during the time of the Mishnah and post-Mishnaically, as opposed to many of the other places we have where we have Mishnah and some Gemara, a lot of Mishnah, a lot of Gemara. Here we have had a lot of Gemara for a relatively small number of, well, next to no, if perhaps even no laws that come from the Torah. So 19a2, that started over on 19a, the previous page, a1. Hakover meto shlosha yamin kodem laregel. If a person buries his dead 3 days before a festival, batla imenu zerat shiva, shiva is canceled. Now this we studied last year, and before we go any further, I just want to say very clearly for those of you who were not here last year that this is not the law. This is not the law. We read about the development of the law here. In fact, the law is if you observe even a short piece of Shiva before the beginning of a festival, that the festival cancels the entire Shiva. That was not the law during the time of the Mishnah. The Mishnah, you had to have observed 3 days. That's what we read here. Batlu eimenu gzerat shloshim. Ashmona, I'm sorry. If the burial was 8 days before the festival, then Shloshim is cancelled. Mipnei she'amru Shabbat Ola ve'ena mafseket. For the sages said, the Sabbath is included in the 7 days of Shiva. Ve'ena mafseket, and doesn't stop them. Legalim mafsikim ve'enan olim, but the festivals cut them off, and they don't count in them. Now, just explain what this is saying, because this is the piece of the Mishnah that we are now going to be dealing with in our Gemara. Shabbat ole ve'enan mafseket. If you have a week of Shiva, it's impossible to have a week of Shiva without a Shabbat in it, right? So if Shabbat had the power to cut off the Shiva, you'd never be able to have Shiva. So in fact, Shabbat Ola, it is counted in the days of Shiva, the Enam of Seket, and it doesn't cut them off. But a regel, the festival is different. The festival is different. If you observe a certain amount of time before the festival, for us, it's just a short time, whatever that is, and the festival comes, it is mafseket, it cuts it off, and you don't, it doesn't fit in the count. Now the count can frequently be in a regel somewhat different. Let's say a death occurs on Yom Tov. Okay? Occurs on Yom Tov of Pesach. Death occurs on the first day of Yom Tov. You can't bury until the third day of Pesach. You might in certain circumstances be able to bury on the second day. In Israel you can bury on the second day easily, because it's Chol HaMoed. I mean, one day of Yom Tov.
But you don't sit Shiva.
But you don't sit Shiva until afterwards. Until afterwards. Question is, does the regal count in terms of the Shiva? Let's say you had in the middle of, you had 4 days into the Yom Tov, and you had 4 days after that if you have an 8-day Yom Tov. Okay, so you had a burial on the 4th day of the Yom Tov, on the 5th day of the Yom Tov. You don't start sitting Shiva until after it's over. Okay, the Yom Tov doesn't cancel anything, but it also doesn't count. It doesn't count. It doesn't add. It doesn't add up. Okay? So that's
so
just the background.
Day one of the Yom Tov.
Correct. Correct. More or less. More or less. In fact, it's not quite that simple. What? No. Oh, it's got to be after the burial, but it's not right after the burial, because if the burial is on Chol HaMoed, there's no Shiva on Chol HaMoed. So Shiva doesn't. There's no Shiva on Chol HaMoed. So you have to wait till after the whole festival is over to begin the Shiva.
So if there's no Shiva on Chol HaMoed, what would be the proper behavior, personal behavior, during those few days of those Chol HaMoed?
Of the mourner?
The garments, the whole, all these things.
Mm-hmm. There aren't a lot of rules for that. But basically, you treat it almost as a Sabbath. Mm-hmm. Because on the Sabbath, it's publicly,
right.
You're not mourning.
Right.
Privately, you are.
Okay.
So the private aspects, and we'll get to them in a short while, they would be in effect, but not the public aspects.
Okay.
You know, I have a question. I mean, I said Shiva. If it would have been cut off by a festival, my feelings would have been bottled up and then wait till the end of the festival to finish Shiva. That would have been difficult for me.
Hmm.
Now, whether that's a universal phenomenon, I don't know, but I imagine it might be.
That is, for better or for worse, not relevant.
Honey?
For better or for worse, that's not relevant. Because when there is a conflict between the community's obligation to celebrate and the individual's obligation to be a mourner, the community takes precedence.
Right.
That's the causing.
Right.
That's the issue. And that's the issue. So indeed, there is a conflict and somebody loses in the conflict. You know, not everybody comes out of every conflict an equal winner.
Right.
So somebody in fact loses in this conflict, and it may be that the mourner could lose in the conflict. It's true. No doubt about it. Which doesn't mean that you're not nice to the mourner. It doesn't mean you don't say something. We talked about that. There, you know, you can, in your personal behavior, still deal with the mourner because the mourner is a mourner. You know, and it's a fresh wound. And nothing has really stopped that from happening. But as far as obligating the community to pay the Shiva call, we cannot do that. We cannot do that. Okay? Okay. 23A2. The quotation was, Nipnei Shamru Shabbat Olah Ve'ena Masekit. Because they said that Shabbat counts and Shabbat doesn't cut off the days of mourning. Now we will try to analyze, see what we can learn, because there are underlying a few issues that have to be fleshed out here. Vene Yehuda uvene Galila, there were two major groups of Jews during the Talmudic period. One were the Vene Yehuda, the Judean Jews, who lived in mostly around Jerusalem, the area around Jerusalem. Keep in mind that the coastal plain, while at certain times in Jewish history was occupied, was until the beginning of the 20th century, was never really occupied to any great degree. We think that people always want to live on the coast. Mm-hmm. If you know the history of Zionism, you know that There's a reason why the Zionist movement in the late 19th century went to the coast. And the reason was that nobody was living there. They went to the coastline. The Zionists went to Petah Tikva, or they went to the area around Tel Aviv, let's say. Okay?
Yeah.
Jaffa, of course, was, since ancient times, was an inhabited place. But the idea of creating farmland, let's say, why did people go to the coast of the plains? In fact, it was swampland. It was not good land. It was difficult land to deal with, and therefore, until the advent of modern agriculture, really people didn't deal with it. The Arabs didn't deal with it. The Arabs didn't cultivate it. What happened in the land of Israel in the late 19th century was that the Jews began to go there. One of the main reasons why they went there was because the Arabs were not there. Land was all owned, of course, by the Turks. It was all owned by Turkish landlords. And the Turkish landlords were delighted. Nobody ever valued that land. So here come the Jews, and they want to pay for the land. Pay for the land! What a windfall! It was the best thing that ever happened to them. So they sold the land. The Jews, by and large, did not occupy Samaria, the Shomron. Why? Because the Arabs lived there. The Arabs were living in the Shomron, and the land in the Shomron was well cultivated. That's why the Jewish community never really developed in the Shomron, whereas it developed along the coastal plain. That's just the history of modern Zionism. So why did I get into this? Why am I telling you about the history of modern Zionism?
Because of the Galilee.
Oh, the Galilee. All right. So, you know, that's modern Zionism. I forgot what the Talmud is. All right. So, B'nai Yehuda, B'nai Galila, right? What you don't have mentioned here are the B'nai the Shomron or the coastal plain, okay? But to whatever extent the B'nai Yehuda are the Shomronim to some extent, because they're living in Jerusalem, Bethel, I'm sure they're living in the outskirts, all that area, okay? That's where the Jews are living, and they're living in the Galilee. Major Jewish community is living in the Galilee. Jerusalem was one, you know, the center, and it comes out of Jerusalem, or the Galilean areas. Okay? So, in fact, in Talmudic times, you have these two different groups. And one time or another, the strength of the Jewish community was either in the area of Jerusalem and around it, but then there was a real decline in the Jerusalem community as a result of the Roman sack of the temple. The Romans set up a Roman city in Jerusalem. Aelia Capitolina was the city of Jerusalem. The Romans moved in full force, and they took over. The Jews got out. The Romans wouldn't, first of all, the Romans wouldn't let them live there. So the Jews moved either to the coastal plain, or close to the coastal plain, to Yavne, right? Which is where Kibbutz Yavne is, close to the coast. Rehovot, that area on the coastal plain, they had a small group of Jews, but the largest community was in the Galilee, because the Romans simply were not interested in populating the Galilee. The Romans were in Caesarea, they were on the coastal plain where they had a port, but Tiberias, for example, never a big Roman city. I mean, you had Romans there, but you had the large Jewish population that stayed there. So in fact, you had these two communities which we can see here.
And
Beit Shan, that's true, that was a Roman city. Beit Shan was a Roman city.
Huge archaeological site.
Correct. It's true.
Megiddo was the main road, which was far inland.
Correct. Well, that's because of the north-south route. Right. That was.
But everything toward the sea was swamp.
Correct.
The only eucalyptus route.
Exactly. So here you have these two communities. And interestingly enough, there's a halachic dispute between the north and Jerusalem, Galilee and Jerusalem. Hani Yamre, Yesh Avelut B'Shabbat. These say that there is the observance of Avelut on Shabbat. V'hane amne ein avelut b'shabbat. And the others say that there is no avelut, there is no mourning on Shabbat. Now, that's interesting. Because the Sabbath is a real problem here. To what extent do the laws of the Sabbath, which is just such a recurring phenomenon, do they really set aside the laws of mourning? Even if we say that the Sabbath counts in the count of seven, and even if we say that it doesn't cut at all, still we're left with a question, and we wonder how we can know the answer to the question of whether you observe the laws of mourning on the Sabbath. Okay? That's a really important question. And it's logically compelling. There's every reason to think that you might not observe the laws of the Sabbath. Sabbath is certainly stricter than the Yom Tov is. Yom Tov is not half as strict as the Sabbath is. Rosh Hashanah doesn't hold a candle to Shabbat. Shabbat is much stricter than Rosh Hashanah. Okay? So if Rosh Hashanah cuts it off, and we see the Sabbath doesn't cut it off, does it at least perhaps mean that you don't observe the laws of mourning on the Sabbath? That's a good question. Okay? Now, in fact, from the Talmud, it's hard to tell exactly who took what, but if you look here, you can see in comment number two, it is the Judeans who hold that there is no observance of mourning on the Sabbath, and the Galileans who hold that there is. That was from other sources, that's what the commentators say. Okay? So the Jerusalemites, or the Judeans, say that there's no mourning on Shabbat, and the Galileans say that there is mourning on Shabbat. Well, let's think about what that means to say that there is or isn't mourning. The Galileans who say that there is mourning on Shabbat, what do they mean that there is mourning on Shabbat? According to all of the commentators, in fact, they don't really mean what it says. In fact, most things are not observed. And what they are referring to is not most things, but private things. This then becomes the issue. Are private areas of mourning observed on Shabbat? So public things, according to the commentators, everybody agrees are not observed on Shabbat. But a lot of Sabbath observance is private in its nature. And there are some laws of mourning that are especially private. Let's take a look and see what these are. Let's take a look, first of all, at the Rashi Ketav Yad, the Rashi manuscript. That's on the inner margin here in the small print. About a third of the way down the page, it says Rashi Kaf Taf Yud Ketav Yad. Yesh Avelut B'Shabbat. She'Avelut Ketzat Noheget B'Shabbat. That there should be a little bit of mourning on Shabbat. So, Yesh Avelut B'Shabbat means not that there is full Avelut on Shabbat, but there are some aspects of mourning that are observed on Shabbat. The one who says that there is no Avelut on Shabbat means that there isn't any Avelut on Shabbat. There's no mourning whatsoever. The one who says that there is mourning on Shabbat doesn't mean all mourning, but a little bit of mourning. Let's see what Rashi says more. Tekatani v'matniten Shabbat olam min haminyan. Because it says in our Mishnah that Shabbat counts in the number. V'ilo nahagu avelut. And if there was no observance of mourning, amai olam min haminyan. Why would it count? If we were to say there's no mourning on the Sabbath, why should it count? There must be some observance of mourning on the Sabbath, okay? Ela vadai avelut b'Shabbat. But there must be mourning on the Sabbath. V'hai de'itzarich lemitnei olah. And the fact that it has to teach us that it counts, the katani mitnei shahashabbat ola. The Sabbath counts, klomar mitnei shahavelut no heget b'shabbat. The fact that it counts, perforce, means that there is some activity of mourning on the Sabbath itself. Okay. Let's look now at the Tosafot. Tosafot, remember, are the generation after Rashi, French commentators of the early 12th century. The very first Tosafot on the page, now the Tosafot is in the opposite place for the Rashi. Rashi normally is here. The Rashi manuscript was over here. Tosafot is the opposite side, on the outer side of the page. The large commentary on the outer side of the page begins, Yesh Avelut B'Shabbat. Right? There is mourning that is observed on the Sabbath. Bidvarim Shebetzina Mayre. This is a very important observation of the Torah, Tosafot. This refers, Mayre means refers in Aramaic, this refers to private matters of mourning. Private matters of mourning. Kidaparish pekuntris, as is explained in Rashi, ubesamuch name lema ketanai, and also further on in the Gemara, it is analyzed in terms of a Tanaitic argument. Maite Plukta, there is a dispute that is brought further on in the Gemara, the Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel, the Rabbanan, between Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel and the rabbis. The Have Dvarim Shebetzina, which refers specifically to private matters in mourning. The Hachi Mashma, Tzat B'Yerushalmi. And this appears to be the meaning, more or less, in the Jerusalem Talmud as well. Dile'el amatnitin, on our Mishnah of above. Dehashabbat ola plige Rabbi Yochanan ve Rabbi Yoshua ben Levi. That there is a dispute in the Jerusalem Talmud on the concept, on the fact that Shabbat counts in the number of Shiva. Right? There's this dispute between Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Yoshua ben Levi. Im asur b'shabbat b'tashmish hamita. This is the key thing. The argument in the Yerushalmi is whether on the Sabbath sex is prohibited while you're a mourner. Mashma de plige ke'en plugta d'hacha. There in the Jerusalem Talmud, these same issues are really being debated. But there it's clear what the substance of the matter is. The substance is sexual relations. So when the Tosafot say Dvarim Shebetzina, the private matters, that in effect is a euphemism, more or less, not entirely the only area of private matters, but that's the crucial area of private matters, because we know that that is one of the basic prohibitions of Avelut, of mourning. So the question is whether sex is permissible. Now, keep in mind that there are particularly certain circumstances where sex is mandatory. Right? In particular, in the laws of sexual relations, a woman has certain rights to demand sexual relations from her husband. It's called ona, the laws of ona. In the Torah. Okay? Suta ba'onata. Lo yigdam imena. The Torah says that a man may not withhold from his wife her ona, which literally means her time.
Period.
Her time. It's the opposite of the period.
Yeah, modern language.
Right, the modern language.
It's the cyclical
correct.
Season.
It's the season.
So, it's important in the law because a woman could divorce her husband if he withheld it from her. It becomes grounds for divorce proceedings. A man owes that to a woman. It's very interesting psychologically and you know, in terms of what people think and thought about sex. I think most modern people would have assumed that before Kinsey the fact that a woman had any interest in this matter never occurred to anybody. But obviously, the law of the Torah has nothing to do with the men, it has to do with the women. So that it's obviously a basic acknowledged fact of human biology and psychology that there's a women's side to it, a woman's side, and a man's side to it, too. And the law of the Torah, in fact, here is concerned with a woman. So keep that in mind, too. If a man has not had relations with his wife, and let's say the time for that is running out, because it will run out in the month as soon as the period begins, period in terms of our modern usage, the menstrual period, because once the menstrual period begins, then she becomes a nida. She is forbidden, according to the Torah, to have relations with her husband. So the whole calculation of the rhythm here, there's a deadline, and the deadline is the beginning of the period. Okay? So let's say that all of these forces conspire so that on the Sabbath of the morning period, he still owes her sex. Well, it's an interesting question. Is it permissible? Right? If there is still mourning on the Sabbath, then the answer is yes. If there is mourning on the Sabbath, and that refers to Dvarim Shebitzina, those things which are in private, then the answer is no. Okay? So that's in a strictly halachic framework, and you could just go beyond that and just say yes or no in general. Okay? So that is the force of this argument, even though it doesn't come across right away in the Gemara. Okay, any questions so far? Okay, so back to the text.
How come the language of the Tosfot, the writing style, is so much actually more, it seems to me more difficult than Rashi, and it's just they were his children, right? Or
grandchildren.
Sons-in-law and so on.
Right. It's a good question. I don't know that we have a good answer to that. But it is certainly true. The other question could be asked the other way around, too. How could it be that Rashi wrote so well? styles of writing change, naturally. And the amazing thing about Rashi's commentary is that it's so good. It's amazingly good. It's so succinct.
Yeah.
Tosafot are anything but succinct. They are all, and they have a pilpulistic style, what we would call pilpulistic, because they'll say, if you could say this, and if you could say that, and then maybe this, and what happens if that, and we know the pilpul, and the style of pilpul is a major style for Talmud study. And it's clear, if you study the history of pilpul, there's always a pro-pilpul side and an anti-pilpul side in the history of rabbinics. And maybe that's what's going on here. Rashi is just the exception to the rule, and in fact there was a lot of pilpul going on. But more than that, I don't really know the answer to. But it is definitely true that Tosafot have a very different style, much more difficult style, and that's why you spend years learning how to understand Tosafot, whereas Rashi can actually be helpful in understanding the text. Frequently, to get to a stage of a Talmudic reading where Tosafot are helpful takes years, because you spend years just trying to figure out what they're saying, let alone to use them to figure out what somebody else is saying. You don't know what they're saying. So when I was in rabbinical school, we must have spent a whole year just on Tosafot. I had one teacher who just was dealing with Tosafot to just try to give you a sense of the rhetorical style. And it's with most of these things. Once you get a sense of rhetorical style, you anticipate what's going to happen. You realize the way they work. And then you begin to be able to undo these things, to unpack them, as we would say. It's a very complex style.
We value and appreciate Rashi now so much more than the others, but has he been consistently respected?
Yeah, Rashi has been. Rashi is extraordinary.
Phase where people wanted wordy and they didn't want succinct.
Well, yes, you did have such as He did have sons like that, but they still appreciated Rashi. Because Rashi just, the truth is, if you were going to read the Gemara, it's impossible to read. You really don't know what the Gemara is saying. You need some commentary. And the Rashi commentaries are very useful and illuminating commentary, no matter who you are, no matter where you want to go from there. You can go from there, and you can do Pilpul, but it's hard to even get to that without having any idea what the text says. And it's nearly impossible to know what the text says from reading the text. You have to read Rashi and not know what the text says. So Rashi has had a very good track record. The only one I can think of that doesn't refer to Rashi, probably for historical reasons, you didn't know Rashi, was Maimonides. And Maimonides is a little after Rashi. It's a little after Rashi. And he does not refer to Rashi. But Maimonides never wrote a commentary on the Talmud the way Rashi did. The closest that he came was to write his Mishneh Torah. He had such a systematic mind that he just, in effect, wrote a commentary by writing a list of all the laws, which has the effect of being a commentary, but it's not really a commentary.
On the subject of Saturday and the laws of bereavement, etc., on that day, it seems to me that the essential point of the Sabbath is, of course, a social one, meaning it is a day of rest. And as a consequence of that, the only prohibition is that you cannot work. But it says nothing about engaging in pleasure or not.
Well, imagine, just keep in mind that rest is not, I mean, it's a very loose word, an English word. The laws of the Sabbath relate to malachot. A malacha, specific activities that are prohibited because those activities were done in the creation of the tabernacle. And, right, sex is surely not one of them, although there is an opinion that it is, because plowing is prohibited.
But agriculture is a problem.
That actually comes up in the Talmud, whether sex is domeh l'charisha, whether we can say that there's some... It's just l'charisha, but it could be zriyato. But it is not dealt with. There's no problem. To the contrary, where those issues come up in the Talmud, the Sabbath is considered to be an ideal time for sexual relations. And later developed in the Kabbalah that it has a mystical significance to it. But that's the nature of rest.
It's procreation. I mean, it's the tension between the community and the individual as well. It's part of a communal responsibility
for
children.
Well, that's good. It's true. But I'm happy to say that it's also an issue in the Sabbath laws of pleasure. That in the Jewish laws having to deal with sexuality, there are two aspects to them. One is procreation, the other is pleasure. And that's why it is permissible to have pleasure even if there be no possibility of procreation, because pleasure is considered to be part of our creation. So both are, in fact, relevant. Yeah.
A vague phrase comes to mind, and I can't remember, but it has to do with harisha.
Rings a bell, but what are you getting, where are you going with
that? I don't remember if that has a sexual connotation.
I don't remember.
You don't remember that?
No.
So you can have sex on Shabbat if you're a mourner.
No, we didn't say that. That is the argument. That's what we have to figure out. That's the question. That's the question. Okay. Top of 23b. All right, we have one point of view says you can, and one point of view says that you can't. The one who says that there is mourning on the Sabbath, which is to say that you can't have sex on the Sabbath, okay? Tikatami Ola. Because the Mishnah said that the Sabbath counts when we add up the 7 days of mourning. Right? It makes sense. If the Sabbath counts, why does it count? Must be that there's something that goes on that's mourning. So what is it? It's got to be the private aspects of mourning. Private aspects of mourning, in fact, happen. Public aspects of mourning do not happen. Because the community is celebrating with Sabbath, so you don't do it publicly. But things that are private, like sex, that you have to observe. Man di amar ein avelut b'Shabbat. How about the other side? The other side that says that there is no mourning on the Sabbath, and that would mean that there could be sex on the Sabbath while you're mourning. The katani ain't enough second. Because it says further on, it does not cut short the days of mourning. It does not cut short the days of mourning. If it doesn't cut them short, right, then it's okay. Okay? Because, wait a second, let me see if there's a comment here. Mandi amar ein avelut b'Shabbat katani ein. It does not cut short the days of mourning. But this is saying the opposite. It's got to make sense. Let's figure out how it makes sense.
It wouldn't say it if it. It wouldn't have to say it doesn't cut short.
Oh, there you go. Dan has it right. If it says it cuts short the days of mourning, why does it have to say that for? It has to say it because you might have thought otherwise, since in fact there is no mourning observance. Okay? So because of that, it has to make an extra statement.
Sure.
Okay? Right. Okay. Hashta isal kedatach yeshavelut b'Shabbat. If you might have thought that there is the observance of mourning on the Sabbath, hashta avelut nahaga avsukim ibaya. Now, if there is avelut that is observed, of course it would cut it off. Of course it would cut it off. Right? So the reason that it just comes is to tell us, in fact, that mourning is not observed, and therefore, but it still doesn't cut it off. Okay? Now it's going to go back and forth several different times. This latter view, then, that says where the Mishnah states that the Sabbath is included in the days of mourning, does this not indicate that there is an observance of mourning on the Sabbath? Okay? Right? That's logical. I did the kavelimitna seifa ein anolin. That's just a stylistic, unusual stylistic fact. Because the second part of the Mishnah wants to tell us about festivals. And it is important to deal with the festival because the festival is mafsik. Right? It cuts off. It cuts the whole thing off. So in order to create a stylistic continuity between the Sabbath and the festivals, it uses the same language, but you shouldn't learn anything as far as the Sabbath goes from the use of that language. Right? We were trying to draw a conclusion based on the use of that language. Okay? Tanaresha Ola. Right, the first Tana who says that it counts. Right? No, Tana Resha. Therefore, the first Tana said that it counts. Now turns it around. Gemara goes and asks how the first view that there is observance of mourning on the Sabbath will respond to the proof for the second view. Leman de'amar yesh avelut b'Shabbat. According to the one who says that there is observance of mourning on Shabbat, hakatani ein amaseket. But it says that the Sabbath doesn't cut off, the Sabbath doesn't cut short the mourning period. Does this not indicate that there is no observance of mourning on the Sabbath? Okay. Mishum dekave lemit naseifa mafsikin tanareisha ein amaseket. It's the same kind of an argument. Because as far as the laws of Yom Tov go, you have a certain way of formulating it, and the same formulation is used as far as the Shabbat goes, and vice versa. Okay? So the effort was tried to make just from the language of the Mishnah to see whether we could learn one way or the other, and unfortunately, we didn't.
So once the Shiva is set for 7 days, Shabbat must be included.
Correct.
Yeah.
The question is, what does that mean? What does it mean to say it's
part of Shiva, Shiva Yamin?
Yeah, but do you observe any Shiva?
Just count it.
Do you just count it? Yes, or do you observe
have to count it?
So the question is that we know. That's what the Mishnah says. But the question is whether from that fact we can also ascertain that you have to observe some mourning on it. One side says, otherwise you wouldn't count it. The other side says, what do you mean? You don't have to count it. Okay, that's the problem that we're dealing with. We don't know the answer yet. Now, of course, you can see that it's very unlikely we're going to get a logical answer for this. There's a much better way to get an answer than a logical answer. When the Gemara has limited resources logically, what does it usually try to do? No, that's a last ditch. It can't solve the problem. Either it will say that there are different circumstances, or in order to even flesh that out, what it's going to look for is a baraita. If we can find an earlier source that either explains it or that decides it, and it would be ideal if we could find an earlier source that has both points of view, and then we see that there is some decision made with those points of view, or there's a fleshing out of the argument, because this we just started with a Mishnah, which really doesn't deal with our issue directly, and we tried to indirectly solve the problem. If we could get a more direct application of a baraita, we would have a better chance of understanding it. So that's where the Gemara is going to try and go now. Lema ketanai. Maybe we can say that this difference of opinion between the Judeans and the Galileans is like a dispute that exists already with the Tanaim. Now, the Tanaim of the earlier teachers, this dispute apparently is a later dispute. Okay, because it's a baraita. Mi shemeto muta lefanav, a person who has his deceased in front of him. Now, this is a technical way of talking about a person who is an onein. An onein means that somebody has died, it is a relative for whom you would be a mourner, and the burial has not yet taken place. So in Talmudic times, the reality of that was meto muta lefanav. The deceased is laid out in front of you. Right? You didn't have a chapel, you don't have a cold storage, the person is just there until the burial actually takes place. This is a baraita now. And it goes on. It's got a lot of details. We'll probably only get the part of it. Ochel bevayet acher. You are supposed to eat literally bevayet acher in another house. Now, what that means halachically is, if you have another house, you eat in another house. But if you have another room in your house, you have to eat in another room in your house. The idea is that you can't eat in the same room as the deceased. Why? It's not because you just can't do it.
Kvodamet.
It's not nice to do.
And eating is a choice.
Exactly. Eating is something that we enjoy. It is a part of our living, and the deceased no longer has that ability. And therefore it is considered to be what's called loeg larash. You're mocking the poor. Right? The met is poor in many ways. Among the ways in which the met is poor is that the met can't eat. And you wouldn't want to, if you have a poor person, you don't want to, in the presence of a poor person, eat a big meal. Because it's not appropriate. If you're going to eat a meal, you do it privately. You don't do it in the presence of the person who doesn't have the meal, assuming you're not going to share the meal. Okay? That's the concept here. That's why when you have the deceased laid out in the house, you go to another room. You go to another room. Elo bayit acher ochel bevet chaveiro. Right? Let's say you don't have that option. So you have to go to your friend's house. Ein lo beit chaveiro. You don't have a friend's house. Oseh lo mechitza asarat fachim. Well, you put up a barrier between yourself and the net. Ein lo davar la'asod mechitza. What if you don't have anything to make a barrier with? We're going all the possibilities here. So you don't have anything to make a barrier with. Machazir panav v'yochel. You turn your face in the opposite direction and you eat. Right? So you see that there is a maximum and a minimum, a maximalist and a minimalist position here, but you do what you can. The enol may say v'ochel. You don't eat by reclining. That in the period of the Talmud was the way fancy people ate. That's why we do it on Pesach. Same verb here, may say.
Misubim.
So you don't eat misubim. Because that's a fancy way of eating. And that, you know, is putting in the knife further. Eino maser v'ochel. Ve'eino ochel basar. Ve'eino shotei yayin. You don't eat meat. And you don't drink wine. Ve'ein mevarech. You don't say, hamotzi lechem min haaretz. Interesting. You don't say much. Why is that?
Yeah,
why is that?
Even if you've gone to another house to eat, you know.
Yeah, even that. Yeah. Why is that? Because the Onein is free from all of the positive commandments of the Torah. The psychological difficulty of being the Onein, of having a deceased who is not yet buried, is considered to be so disconcerting that we do not require a person to observe the laws of the Torah, except insofar as those laws are negative laws. You're not allowed to do things which you are prohibited.
But
you can't eat something that's not kosher. But you don't put on tefillin. You don't recite the Shema. Those are positive commandments. So one is free from all of the positive commandments of the Torah. Okay, it's all part of aninut.
You
should
not.
You should not.
Well,
yeah, but if you say that, you probably know the more supposed of morning also. In which case, you would know that you just don't, you don't do that. Okay. Be continued.
Thank you.
Did you learn why there are seven punches in 7 days?
I think we did, but I think that's the other one.